Thank you so much for being here tonight. We've got, again, as this morning, we've got a lot of visitors. We're thankful for that. We've got a lot of our regular members here, and I'm thankful for that too. We spent a lot of time as a congregation here this year focusing on our need for knowledge, our need to know the will of God. And we have really kind of zeroed in on that, not just this year, but this month, and specifically on Sunday nights, we have really turned our focus to knowledge, and we've been doing that from the perspective of the Psalms. And I made mention of this last week, that there's a lot of redundancy. When we're focusing on knowledge, maybe it seems like we're always making the same application. But I don't really hesitate to do that, and the reason I don't hesitate to do that is because I think it's important. But second, it's a redundancy that the Bible itself doesn't try to hide. It's just imperative that if we're going to serve God, we're going to have to know God. We're going to have to know what He's revealed. It is going to have to be ingrained in us. It's going to have to be in our heart if it's going to produce in us what God wants it to produce in us. You know, we can be as sincere as we want to be, but without a knowledge of God, I just can't serve God the way that He wants me to. I can't offer something to God that I don't know to offer. And I can't fashion my life after something that I don't really have an acquaintance with. And so as we think about knowledge, it's imperative. And I hope we don't ever lose our thirst for knowledge. Our dedication to live by the will of God has got to be matched with this dedication to know the will of God. And so I hope we'll keep that in the forefront of our mind. Now, tonight, I'm going to keep our study within the realm of knowledge. We're still going to think about knowledge, but tonight we're going to think about it from kind of the opposite direction. We've been really focused on us knowing what God has revealed. Psalm 139 tells us what God knows about us. And so we're going to focus on God's knowledge of us tonight, and we're going to make some applications for that. I think this psalm is really kind of broken down into to maybe three different sections. And so I just want to look at these three sections, and then we'll stop and make some observations in between all of them. Let's first of all read the first 12 verses. It says, O Lord, You have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You understand my thought from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down, and are intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there is a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, You know it all. You have enclosed me behind and before, and laid Your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain to it. Where can I go from Your Spirit? Or where can I flee from Your presence? If I ascend to heaven, You are there. And if I make my bed in Sheol, behold, You are there. If I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, even there Your hand will lead me, and Your right hand will lay hold of me. If I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me, and the light around me will be night, even the darkness is not dark to You, and the night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike to You. Several things to observe. Maybe the most obvious thing that stands out in this section is that God knows everything. And specifically, God knows everything about me. Notice the language that is in the first few verses, that He has searched. And He knows, and He understands, and He is intimately acquainted. You couldn't really explain that anymore, that God knows everything about me. And He doesn't just know my actions. He's not just observed what I've done. But verse 2 tells us that He knows even our thoughts. Verse 4 tells us that before a word is even on my tongue, He knows it. And so what this puts in our minds is God knows everything, even our thoughts. If I say something, He knew it before I said it. If I do an action, He knows. And so He even knows what motivates me to say the things that I do and do the things that I do. And so just for emphasis, I think David, the psalmist here, describes the extent of that. And he explains it as when you're lying down, and when you're rising up, and when you're sitting, and when you're walking, that would really encompass every part of a person's day. And God knows every part of our day. And it's in every place too. He even mentions places that we can't even take ourselves. Like, I can't take myself to heaven, and I can't take myself to Sheol, but even if I could, I wouldn't escape God knowing. And he says that I can even go to the remotest parts of the earth, the darkest place imaginable, and I would not be able to escape God. And in verse 6, he states, I think what we know is that we can't even really comprehend that. How does God know my faults? You ever think about that? How does He know a word before it even enters my mouth? And how does He not just know all of that, and not just about me, but how does God know about everybody all at the same time? That's kind of mind-blowing, isn't it? I can't even fathom that. How God would know that about me, but at the same time, He would know all of those same things about you and billions of other people all at the same time. Think for a minute. Can you even begin to count the number of thoughts that you have in a day? Where would you start? How would you tally that up? The number of thoughts that you have in the span of a day. That's an unfathomable number, isn't it? Yet what David reveals to us and what he freely admits, this is too high. We can't understand. We can't attain to it. But what he admits is that God knows all of that. Now, I can't understand the complexity of all of that. But really, rather than focusing on the complexity and trying to figure out how God can do all of that, maybe what we really need to figure out or focus on is the simplicity of the fact that it is a reality that God does know everything. And I think we need a real sense of that in our lives. When you think about this truth, when you think about the fact that God knows everything about you, is that a scary thought? Or is that a comforting thought? And I say the answer is yes. It's a very sobering thought to know that nothing about my life can be hidden from God. My innermost thoughts cannot be hidden. And you know, we might even be tempted to think that we can hide something from God. And I would say that's a little bit of a silly notion because we know we can't, yet we think we can. That's kind of weird, isn't it? And maybe partially we think that about God because of how good we are at maybe hiding things from each other. We can deceive other people. And we can hide things within us that nobody would ever know. And there are things that we can just guard within us that might not ever be known to another human being, even the people that live with us. Now, I'm not suggesting we keep a lot of secrets from our spouses, but you understand what I'm saying. We get really good, if we want to be, sometimes at just hiding things. And maybe we get so good at hiding things from each other, and we're so successful at hiding things from each other, we kind of conjure up this idea in our minds that I'm sure God knows about this. Now, it's foolish to think in that way, but I suggest we might all be tempted to think in that way sometime. So what this reminds us is we just need to be honest about who we are. And we just need to be honest about how we're talking and how we're living and how we're treating other people. Because we cannot hide it from God. We might fool other men. But you think about the awareness that we really just need in our lives to this fact that God knows everything. You just think about in this way. If you could see God, how much difference would that make in the way that you act? If when you went to work, you were able to see God, and He's just kind of standing right there beside you. And in your private conversations, what if He were there? And what if He were sitting here? Actually, what if He were standing where I am? Because you can see everything from here. But what if... what if we could envision Him here? Well, how would that change us? How much differently would we talk to our spouse if God were here? And how much differently would we worship? How much more inclined would we be to open our Bibles and to open our mouths and to open our hearts? And how quickly would we turn the television if something sinful was there and we're finding ourselves enjoying it and being entertained by it? If God were sitting right there, don't you think you'd probably change that a little bit quicker than we do sometimes? You get the point. And I think maybe sometimes because we don't have a visual of God being here, we kind of put it out of our minds. But we understand that there is no hiding from God, whether we see Him or not. And so we need to just live like that. Now, I mentioned that's the sobering part, but there's also the comforting part too. And I really think that's the point that David is making in this psalm, the comforting part, that where can I go? And he talks about despair. He talks about seemingly a time of crisis, and he says that there's not a despair so deep that God can't be there for that. You can't be in such a dark place in which God can't be there. And he even says, God, darkness is not even dark to you. And that's a really comforting thing to know, that I'll never escape the eyes of God. I'll never have something wrong done to me that God doesn't see. And I'll never make a sacrifice that God doesn't see. And I'll never find myself in a place that God doesn't know I'm there and have the ability to bring me out of. And so as sobering as it is to know that God knows everything and that God is everywhere, it's comforting at the same time. And I hope we're living in a way in which the comforting part is better to us than the scary part. But I suggest both are there. Let's read the next section. Starting in verse 13, it says, "For you formed my inward parts. You wove me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in your book were all written the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them. How precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. When I awake, I am still with you. Now, there's kind of a continuation along that same line of thought, but David kind of takes it a little bit deeper. And what he expresses is that God doesn't just know who I am now, God has always known me. God knows me and has known me pre-existence. And that's because God is the one that made us. God, as David describes it here, formed us. He wove us. And you know what's awesome about that is he didn't make any mistakes when he made me. I am wonderfully made. And so are you. And that is just a precious thought to know that God made you and He made you wonderful. You are what you are because God made you that way. If you've got blonde hair and blue eyes, it's because that's how God formed you, with the exception of trips to the beauty shop. But that's how God formed you. God made you. And that Calvinistic idea that we come from our mother's womb and we're already sinful and we're so totally depraved that we can't even imagine serving God. Well, Psalm 139 just flies all in the face of that. Because God made me wonderful. And this idea that I'm born with some sinful tendency that I'll never be able to break, and because of that sin, God will destroy me in hell forever. Well, that's not what Psalm 139 says. God made me and you wonderful. And what really stands out to me about all of this is how important I must be to God. God is not just some distant creator that a long time ago decided that he was going to create this world and he wanted it to be full of people, and so he just kind of put the wheels in motion and now he just sits back and lets nature do its thing. Now, I'm not suggesting that sometimes God doesn't just let nature run its course, because I think sometimes he does. But human life is not just part of nature running its course while God sits back and watches everything unfold. God is involved in the creation of every human life. And sometimes when we think about this plan of God, the salvation that God has offered, and we go to Ephesians 1, like we looked at in our study this morning, and we see that before the foundation of the world, God had this plan and He brought it through Christ and He did it out of love. Well, sometimes that plan kind of seems distant. Well, it's distant in the sense that it was conceived a long time ago and the wheels were put in motion a long time ago. But God made me, and He made you with that plan in mind. And so God is not just some distant creator who's just sitting back and watching everything happen as it may. And you wonder, well, what does all of this have to do with my pursuit of knowledge? And what does all of this have to do with righteousness? Well, here's what I think. I think what David is showing us in this psalm is that God is deeply invested in me. And God is deeply invested in you. He took the time to make you. And He has a tremendous interest in your life. And because God created me, and He created me with a purpose, because I understand how deeply invested God is in me, I in turn want to be deeply invested in Him. That's what this has to do with knowledge. That's what this has to do with righteousness. God created me with a purpose, and He loves me, and He's deeply invested in me. And what I really want to do because of that is I want to be deeply invested in Him. And I want to know what that purpose is. And I want to set in my heart to live out all of my days according to His purpose. That's what this has to do with knowledge. Let's look at the last section, beginning in verse 19 through the rest of the chapter. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, men of bloodshed. For they speak against you wickedly, and your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with the utmost hatred. They have become my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts, and see if there be any hurtful way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way. This last section seems to be really different than the first two sections that we just read. And it's maybe not even immediately clear, what's the connection between those first two sections and this section where you've got all of this harsh language? And that might not be immediately clear, but here's a thought about that. I believe that David is kind of responding in that way that I just mentioned, that he has seen God being deeply invested in him, and in return, he's deeply invested in God. He has cultivated such a relationship with God that he's developed this loyalty towards God. He has developed this allegiance towards God, and it's a loyalty and allegiance that is so deep and so strong, he's offended that anybody would live in rebellion against God. He has reached a point into where he hates what God hates. And it's almost as if he's looking at these terrible people in the world, and he's kind of wondering, how can you be this way based on the fact that God made you and he made you for something so much better than what you are? And I think David despises men because they have completely ruined God's purpose for their life. And I don't even know what to make out of some of the strong language there, the harshness and the hatred. But what I do believe is that David has a sense of defending God. And I believe that all of us need that in our own life. That when we hear evil men speak evil against God, well, what ought that do to me? That ought to offend me. And I ought to despise the words that despise God. And so when sin and wickedness is displayed around us, what it ought to do is upset us that people are living that way towards God. We need to be sensitive to wickedness. And that's kind of maybe hard to do because we live in a world that we would agree is predominantly wicked. And that's going to mean that we're offended quite a bit. And that means that we're not necessarily going to know how to process all of the things that go on around us. But I think there's something to be learned. Just like we need that sense of awareness that God is here, we need that sensitivity towards wickedness too. To where we're bothered by it. To where it does offend us. But I think there's something else here, and maybe this is the most important thing. I believe, starting in verse 24 or 23, what David acknowledges is that he himself is not above wickedness. He's not above being wrong in the eyes of God either, because notice what he says. Search me and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts, and see if there be any hurtful way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way. You understand what he's saying? God, you created me, and you made me wonderful, and there's a purpose, and I just want to return I just want to give my life to be what you want it to be. And here I see all of these wicked men around me, and I hate it, I despise it, I loathe it. But God, I certainly don't want to be that. And so God, search me, and if in me you find any wicked way, if there's hurt that you find in me, lead me away from that. And I think that's the kind of passion that I need. And I hope that I can only be so passionate about serving God. And I hope that I'm only so sensitive, that I'm so sensitive to evil and wickedness. I hope all of that working within me makes me say the same thing. That if there's anything wrong within me, God, show me that and lead me out of it. I hope that we can all be that passionate about serving God. But the real question is, are we willing to just stand here open before God and say, all right, examine me top to bottom. Look at every part of me and then tell me what's wrong. Are you willing to do that? It's hard to do, isn't it? You know, I mentioned last week when we were studying from another psalm. You know, there may be people coming to church that can't really listen all that closely, and they can't really listen all that closely because they may hear something they don't like to hear. And do you think it might be possible that we're not just willing to stand before God and say, search me, because we're afraid what he might find? And we're kind of a little bit hesitant to say, lead me in the right direction, because we're a little bit afraid he might lead us in a direction and I'm not really wanting to go there right now. That's what we all have to wrestle with. And that's what we all have to decide. Am I so passionate about serving God that I'll just say, search me and point me in the right direction? And I hope that I'm that passionate, and I hope that you're that passionate too. And so what we've been studying about is this idea that what we know about God should drastically change the way that we're living. And tonight, the real thing is what God knows about me should drastically change the way that I'm living. And so there may be, no, let me say this first. There are, I think, tonight, a lot of people here who are passionate about serving God. And you're willing to say, God, search me. And if you find a hurtful way in me, if you find something wrong in me, lead me. And I believe that there are people that are so sincere and so passionate, if they saw something, they would change. And I sincerely believe that if we honestly ask God to point us in the right direction, He will. And I don't know how all of that might work. Maybe it's through our Bible reading, or maybe it's through a sermon or a Bible class, or maybe it's a brother that comes to us and points something out. But I firmly believe that if David had a hurtful way in him, God would show him that. And I believe the very same thing is true for me and for you. If there are wrong ways in your life, God will show those to you, but it's up to you to change. And so maybe there's someone here tonight who knows, and let me just suggest, if there are wrong ways in you, you probably know them. That's just the reality. So let me encourage you to change them. And I don't know what it might take for you to change what's wrong in your life. It might just be some kind of slight adjustments. But it might be some major things too. And there may be things that you need to change that you can kind of handle on your own. But there's really not any virtue in just keeping it all to yourself and struggling with it all alone. When God's given you a whole family full of people that will help you. And so tonight, if you find a wrong way in your life and you want to get right, then let somebody help you get right. And it may be that you want a lot of people helping you, and so maybe you're going to take the opportunity that's about to be presented, and you want to come forward as we sing, and you just want to ask for help, then do that. Maybe you want to ask for it privately, and that's understandable, and you can do that too. Maybe, though, you just need to do something, and that's what I want to encourage you to do. Do whatever you need to do. Nothing is not the right answer. God made you, and He made you for a purpose. And so if you're not living a life that fulfills that purpose, make it do that. If we can help you, we invite you to come to the front as we stand and sing.